From Pacifica Radio, broadcasting from Los Angeles, this is Democracy Now! The first police inspector general in Los Angeles resigns, saying she doesn't have the power, access, or independence she needs to investigate the LAPD. But first, a conversation on the history of progressive Los Angeles. And it's the 7th anniversary of the Dili massacre. There'll be protests around the country as Indonesia increases its troop strength in East Timor. We'll talk with some activists. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Jakarta. Indonesian troops have opened fire to block students who broke through police lines while attempting to reach the parliament. Witnesses said some of the shots were fired into the crowd and at least one person was wounded. Troops let off several warning shots to block students about half mile from parliament, and then some shots were fired into the crowd. Despite his claim to have ratified the latest peace accord with the Palestinians, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced today his government would begin construction of a large Jewish settlement in a sector of Jerusalem claimed by the Palestinians as a future capital. Palestinian spokesman Ahmed Tibi denounced the construction plans as a violation of the peace accords that would bring a serious response. Mustering for a possible attack on Iraq, U.S. forces began to converge on the Gulf today as Saddam Hussein defies demands that he submit to U.N. arms inspections. President Clinton says he's ready to use force to compel Baghdad to stop obstructing the operation to find and destroy its nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain, Washington's staunch ally, warned today that Saddam's time is running out. A Chilean general accused of human rights abuses during the Pinochet dictatorship will leave his UN post within a month to return to the Chilean army with a promotion. The International Organization Human Rights Watch, which had protested Brigadier General Sergio Espinosa Davies' position as chief of the UN military observer mission in India and Pakistan, welcomed his departure, but said his elevation to major general showed the weakness of Chile's claims of democracy. Chile informed the United Nations of its decision in a letter this week. Without mentioning the human rights allegations, Chile said Espinosa would become inspector general of the Chilean army by December 15th, an important position that places Espinosa as the army's fifth-ranked general. Meanwhile, this news from Britain on the situation as well in Cambodia, and that is the House of the Lords has just finished its appeal hearing in the case of Pinochet. From Bogota, Colombia's Air Force finds itself weathering another drug trafficking scandal following this week's seizure in Florida of an Air Force cargo plane allegedly carrying 1,600 pounds of cocaine. Colombia's Air Force commander resigned this week after U.S. Customs authorities at the Fort Lauderdale International Airport said they found cocaine stashed aboard the plane. No arrests or criminal charges have been announced in the seizure. This news from Phnom Penh, Cambodian opposition leader Prince Norodom Sihanouk said today he would form a coalition government with his bitter rival, Premier Hun Sen. He made the comment to Reuters shortly after his return home from Thailand for talks with Hun Sen, who's struggling to form a new government over 3 months after disputed elections. And from Ankara, Turkey, Turkish Prime Minister Mesut Yılmaz's minority coalition's fighting for survival today as a leftist former backer launched a censure bid to topple the government over alleged corruption. The switch in allegiance by the left-wing politician Denis Baykal followed taped accusations by a businessman of high-level graft in a $600 million state bank privatization tender this year. Yılmaz vowed to defend his conservative-led government. And this more specific news on what's happening with Pinochet in Britain. The highest court finished hearing arguments today over whether the London arrest of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet was legal. Lord Slynn, chief of a five-judge panel in the House of the Lords, said judgment would be reported to the full House in due course. The law lords were hearing an appeal against a ruling last month by the High Court, which said that Pinochet was immune from arrest because the offenses of which he's accused took place while he was head of state in Chile. And the United States hopes Asia-Pacific economies can agree on ways to boost growth in the battered region, including strategies for financial sector reform and corporate debt restructuring, this according to a U.S. official. From Washington, former President Jimmy Carter says the United States lacks international support for attacking Iraq, but he thinks other nations might accept the use of military force if it's narrowly targeted. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Los Angeles from the Pacifica studios of KPFK. I'm Amy Goodman. There are many people for whom the words progressive LA may seem like an oxymoron. Granted, those who think like this live in gritty, palm tree-less places in the Midwest and the East Coast. But in fact, progressive social movements have strong roots in LA's history, from the emergence of strong environmental and women's movements in the 1920s to novelist Upton Sinclair's 1934 run for governor on the slogan End Poverty in California, up to the civil rights movement and the emergence of Cesar Chavez's efforts to organize farm workers in the 1960s. Progressive movements in Los Angeles have undergone as many transformations as the fast-growing metropolis has experienced itself. As the gap between the city's rich and poor continues to expand, progressives are regrouping around pressing social issues such as immigration, labor rights, and police brutality, and a new and very diverse civic left is emerging. This past month, activists from the left of center got together at the Progressive LA Conference at Occidental College to review their history and define their agenda for the coming millennium. The conference was sponsored by the American Civil Liberties Union, the LA County Federation of Labor, the Liberty Hill Foundation, the Nation Institute, the Southern California Library for Social Studies and Research, and the LA Weekly. We're joined right now by the executive editor of the LA Weekly, Harold Meyerson. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Harold.
It's a pleasure to be here, Amy.
Well, it's great to be here in Los Angeles, and getting a chance in these days to meet with a number of people from around the country. In fact, I believe that Juan Gonzalez will be joining us in New York, and he is writing a book, actually, on Latinos in America. But he's not with us right now, and we wanted to turn to you to get a kind of lay of the land over the decades about the progressive history of Los Angeles. Next in the show, we'll be talking about the police inspector general, the first one ever in this city, appointed after the Rodney King situation. And now she has resigned, and we're going to have a conversation about what was her role and what she was able to accomplish and not accomplish. But right now, the history of progressive LA. Let's take a walk through it. Where do we start?
Los Angeles is a surprising city when viewed from afar, and it's a surprising city when viewed close up. L.A. has always had an active left here, going back to in its sort of Chinatown big business domination period. There still was, at that point, a vibrant municipal socialist movement in the 1900s and the 1910s. Which almost won the mayoralty here back in 1911. Of course, all kinds of upsurges in the 1930s when Upton Sinclair won the Democratic gubernatorial nomination with an essentially socialist platform in 1934.
Remind listeners who Upton Sinclair was.
Upton Sinclair was the muckraking novelist, author of The Jungle, which had actually was written, I think, like 28 or 27 years before he ran for governor of California, a leading social critic and novelist, a sort of expose novelist of different industries and different injustices, sort of in a niche which isn't really quite being occupied in American letters at all these days. The notion of novels as muckraking vehicles is sort of fallen off the off the map. But it was very much on the map then, and he was one of the people who put it there and kept it there. Ran for governor of California in 1934, having re-registered from Socialist, which had been his lifelong affiliation to that point, to Democrat, and with a plan to end poverty in California, and was just part of a whole, you know, the ferment of 1934, which also saw the general strike in San Francisco, the founding of the West Coast Longshoremen Union, all sorts of activities. He didn't make it, although 4 years later, the state got its first Democratic governor who had been associated with the End Poverty in California campaign. One thing we did at this Occidental conference that you referred to is we found a few veterans of the 1934 campaign who talked about it, as well as Greg Mitchell, who authored a book on Upton Sinclair and that campaign. Augustus Hawkins, who was a was elected to the California Assembly in 1934 from Watts, a black member of the Assembly, and served there for like 25 years, and then served in Congress for 25 years, and came in really sort of fine form at age 91 to partly to reminisce, but mainly to say what's wrong with education policy in America today. And then a number of folks who had been active in a range of social movements, Alice McGrath from the Sleepy Lagoon case,
which
dealt with just sort of some police actions that were really abusive of Latinos who were arrested on some bogus charges during World War II. And she was a young woman who put together, worked for the defense committee there, and became sort of the basis for a character in the Luis Valdez play Zoot Suit, which was 20 some odd years after the event. Frank Wilkinson, who was active in the one progressive mayoralty of mid-century as is a public housing director in Los Angeles, and then later blacklisted and became a very trenchant critic of L.A. police practices, FBI practices, and so on. Maury Wiener, who had been sort of the, I guess, consigliere, you might say, to Tom Bradley during his rise on the city council in the early years of his mayoralty, on sort of putting together the one center-left mayoralty candidacy that succeeded that L.A. has seen in half a century. Paul Schrade, who was a Western Regional Director of the United Auto Workers, had been really the first union leader, established union leader, to discover and help out Cesar Chavez and set up some of the major community-based entities that followed Watts in 1965, a really kind of cross-cutting bunch of folks. And so this conference looked back at what the L.A. left, or maybe I should say lefts, had been in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s through some personal testimony, and then had a range of activists today comparing notes, and had at the conclusion on a panel that I chaired, a number of elected officials and folks who were sort of leading strategists of progressive LA today, talking about the future of the city and what the left has to say about that.
Harold Meyerson is our guest. He's the executive editor of the LA Weekly here in Los Angeles, where I'm broadcasting from this week, but my co-host Juan Gonzalez remains in New York, and he is joining us now. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy and Harold. We had a little problem here with our coast-to-coast anchoring here, so I've been listening to the program, but I think we're finally all together now.
Well, it's great to be with you. And Juan, I know that you also have some questions for Harold Meyerson on the history of progressive Los Angeles.
Yes. One of the questions I've been wondering about, Harold, as I've been listening to you, is that it seems to me that at least the progressive movement there in Los Angeles, probably in the earlier part of the century, operated on two tracks. So one would be the white community of Los Angeles, and the other, of course, a large it's always been large, Mexican community of Los Angeles, because I know that in the early 1900s, of course, the seminal event or the most influential event of in that part of the country was the Mexican Revolution, and many of the progressive Mexicans who were either supporters of the revolution or in many cases, those who participated directly came back and forth from Los Angeles and raised support for the revolution in the United States from Los Angeles, as well as a burgeoning theater movement, a progressive theater movement that really arose out of Los Angeles and the Mexican theater in the 1920s. I'm wondering if, in terms of the conference, of any of this dual track that developed in terms of progressivism was dealt with.
Well, Bert Corona was there and on that panel as well, and spoke about some of that. And it is certainly true that this kind of sort of cross-border ferment, particularly around the time of the 20s, was a big deal here. I must say, since we're dealing with personal testimony, there are not too many survivors of a period that far back, a period when the L.A. Archdiocese under Archbishop Cantwell was bitterly opposed to the anti-clericalism of the Mexican Revolution, and there was certainly some tension here in L.A. and within the Archdiocese as a result of that. But we also one of the most exciting things about Los Angeles today is the more recent transformation of the city by the last 20 years of immigration, and how that has really recomposed what the left is going to be here. And it has created a kind of economic profile of the city which takes us right back to pre-New Deal days. I think the most striking thing about socioeconomic Los Angeles today is that two-thirds, this is by a recent study of the California committee in the California State Assembly, two-thirds of the people living in L.A. County live in households with incomes of under $40,000 a year annually, and the people who make in households making between $40,000 and $100,000 a year, that number has actually declined since the early 1990s, so the county is growing. And then there's an uptick in the people making over $100,000. In other words, this is increasingly a two-tier city, and the municipal left, the civic left in L.A., is, I think, finally and somewhat effectively over the last 2 years beginning to turn its attention to the huge issues of low-paid work, which L.A., I think, has the unfortunate distinction of being the American capital.
Harold Meyerson is our guest. You know, last night, and I hope to be playing some of this next week on Democracy Now!, perhaps even later this week, I had the chance to see Jerry Adams. Now, what does Jerry Adams have to do with the politics of Los Angeles, the president of Sinn Féin? Well, he was just stopping in Los Angeles on his way to Mexico. And so there was a reception for him at a local hotel that was held by State Senator Tom Hayden and State Senator Richard Polanco. And it was held for him so that he could greet and meet and talk with some Latino legislators in the state. One of the big things, of course, and you were just mentioning that's happened in the state, is the tremendous increase in the Latino vote and how that's changing the landscape of this state.
Yeah, if you look at the exit polling, which is a more imprecise science than some non-exit polling, but if you look at the exit polling from the California election of a week ago, the stunning thing, the most striking thing, is that while 4 years ago non-white voters constituted 17% of the electorate, last week they constituted 34% of the electorate. They doubled. This explains, Gray Davis would have won the governorship here anyway, since he won by a 20% margin. But all the statewide Democrats won by about 5% more than any of their tracking polls had shown. And this simply meant that the Latino community and the African-American community and even the Asian community, which once they finished dealing with the Senate race, which pitted Matt Fong against Barbara Boxer, then reverted to Democratic voting, all turned out in far greater numbers than anyone had anticipated, which was one of the reasons for the Democratic sweep in this state. There's no question that a whole series of areas around L.A., now Latinos are a dominant factor in voting, even parts of northern Orange County, which are traditionally, for time immemorial, white Republican.
And also indicates that polls do not accurately, particularly poll, in low-income communities or communities of color. Harold Meyerson's our guest. We're going to be back with him in just a minute. He's the executive editor of LA Weekly. And after we wrap up with him, we're going to have a conversation about the surprise resignation of the first police inspector general in Los Angeles and why it is she felt she could not do her work. Then we're going to be talking about protests happening around the country today on the 7th anniversary of the Dili massacre in East Timor, when Indonesian soldiers opened fire on Timorese using U.S. M-16s and killed more than 250 of them. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Los Angeles, and Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, is in New York. We're finishing up our conversation with Harold Meyerson, just taking a walk through the history of progressive L.A. Harold Meyerson, the executive editor of the L.A. Weekly. What about labor organizing and its history in Los Angeles?
Obviously, L.A. is a city with a long and at times explosive history of labor organizing. The explosive literally can refer us back to the L.A. Times in 1910, a notoriously anti-union paper where a bomb was set off in 1910 at a printing facility and killing some folks. Throughout the 30s, obviously, major CIO upsurge. What's interesting about L.A. And labor is where it's at today. In the last 2 years, sort of the perestroika of American labor has had its local counterpart and its state counterpart, which is to say shortly after John Sweeney became the president of the national AFL-CIO, new leadership took over both the state AFL-CIO and the L.A. County Federation of Labor, which is now headed by Miguel Contreras, who comes out of the hotel and restaurant union. And under Contreras, the L.A. County Federation has really become the powerhouse of progressive politics in L.A., winning a whole series of interesting elections, winning elections where they would back a candidate who was sort of more explicitly progressive and with more cross-racial appeal in several instances than the more favored candidate who was more, for lack of a better term, establishment Latino, always winning those elections, winning slate and city charter reform elections, and really being absolutely key to the Democratic upsurge what had long been Republican areas that are demographically changing, like Glendale and Pasadena, like northern Orange County. The labor movement has been absolutely the key mobilizer for the immigrant population into the electorate. And this
Ask you about the, in the little time that we have left, about some of the civic organizations. I know going back to the 40s, for instance, the community service organization, the old CSO, had an enormous impact. It helped propel Ed Roybal to become the first a Mexican-American elected official and did a lot of organizing in community community organizations. What's and of course you had things like the Labor Community Alliance that Eric Mann has headed for many years out there. What's been the role of these civic organizations in terms of pressing forward a public involvement in progressive causes?
Well, they've been very important. This is a city that has thrived on that kind of organizing, and it kind of waxes and wanes in peculiar patterns that I don't think anyone can quite decipher. The IAF organizations, the Industrial Area Foundations organizations affiliated with the national group, which comes down from Saul Alinsky's founding them, have in different times been quite strong here. In the late 80s and early 90s, UNO, the United Neighborhoods Organization, was a major force in Latino and East Side politics in particular, so much so that they basically successfully spearheaded a raise in the minimum wage in the state, although there were Republican governor during this period who was not too crazy about this, nonetheless had amassed enough political and moral capital, perhaps more moral than political, to push that through. UNO has somewhat faded from the scene, but I think there are signs that it is resurging. Other such organizations around L.A. as well, some economic justice organizing always around the Los Angeles area, in more industrial working class areas. A lot of that is going on, and I think what's exciting now is a number of these groups, I think, are going to be beginning to talk A, to each other more, and B, to groups in other issue areas more, as well as a civic left in Los Angeles, I think, begins to really come together.
Finally, Harold Meyerson, how did the LA Weekly get its start?
The LA Weekly, actually, we are having our 20th anniversary issue in a week. We got 20, we're hitting the 20-year mark. Jay Levin and some people who had been active in mainstream and then alternative journalism in the 60s decided that the city could support an alternative newspaper, went around banging a tin cup and got some really pretty feisty and terrific writers back at the in the mid-70s, and put together a paper coming out of in part of the movements of that period. I just did a review for our next issue on political writing in the Weekly over 20 years, and certainly in our first period, this paper was like the definitive expression of opposition, resistance, exposés on American policy in Central America.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Harold Meyerson. He is executive editor of the LA Weekly. And if people want to see the LA Weekly and they don't live in Los Angeles, is there a website that you have?
There sure is, www.laweekly.com. And most of our stuff is up there every week in all its varied glory.
And what day do you publish?
We publish on Thursday, although I think we're actually up on the website by late Wednesday.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue to look at the politics of Los Angeles today. Under pressure from the Los Angeles Police Commission, Inspector General Catherine Mader announced this week she'll resign from her position. She was the first person to hold the post of official watchdog of the L.A. Police Department following the landmark 1991 Christopher Commission report written in the aftermath of the Rodney King beating. Her position was supposed to provide the public with a window into the LAPD's discipline system. According to police sources quoted in the Los Angeles Times, high-level police commission bosses were troubled by Mader's strong will and assertiveness. Meanwhile, sources close to Mader say she felt handcuffed by the commission, which she believed did not want her to probe anything that might make the department or the chief of police look bad. We're joined right now by two people to talk about the situation with the police and Mader's resignation. Michael Zinzin is with us, chairperson of the Coalition Against Police Abuse in Los Angeles, a former member of the Black Panthers, has brought two successful suits against the police department and a third against the Pasadena Police Department because of a terrible beating he got in the 1980s. We're also joined by Ramona Ripston, who is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California and knows the case of the police inspector general, Kathryn Mader, well. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Ramona Ripston. Can you explain what exactly, to a national audience, has happened with this inspector general job and why Mader has resigned?
Well, good morning, and I'm not sure I know exactly what happened. I can tell you, I can speak only as someone who has watched the police department, the new police chief, and the inspector general and the police commission. I think what happened was that the Christopher Commission report said that we needed to have good civilian oversight. Kathryn Mader was hired to be the first inspector general, and during the last year of Willie Williams' tenure, that worked terribly well. She did. She came to a job that had never been in existence before. She did it competently. She did it well. In fact, if you go back and read newspapers, what you'll find is that there was no controversy about this job. Nobody talked about it. Even the ACLU, a group that watches the police department, we had no problems with the inspector general, and nobody seemed to have. It perhaps had to do with Ray Fisher, who was the chair of the police commission at that point. But when Ray Fisher went to Washington, D.C., Edith Perez became the head of the police commission, and Bernard Parks became the police department head. Well, Bernard Parks is a longtime police officer who is who has, I believe, a military style. He is unwilling to listen to people in the community. He is unwilling to listen to what we have to say about civilian oversight.
Juan, you go next.
Hello?
Yes.
And I think in this, since Ray Fisher left, Kathryn Mader has tried to do her job. I think Bernard Park believes that he should be in charge of discipline. And the first sign we had was we and other organizations had worked with the police commission in terms of disciplinary guidelines. And Parks said, we don't want those guidelines. I want to be in charge of discipline. And unfortunately, the commission went along with him. So I think Kathryn Mader finally left. It's rumored that she was going to be fired. I don't know whether that's true or not. But she left because she couldn't do the job anymore, because the police commission and Bernard Parks wouldn't let her. And I am very worried about the situation. And I think all people who care about police reform, who care about civilian control of the police department, should be concerned about what's happened over these last couple of days.
I'd like to ask Michael Zinzin a question.
Juan, we're having a little technical problem here, and I don't think Michael Zinzin is able to hear your question. Michael Zinzin, chair of the Coalition Against Police Abuse in Los Angeles. But Juan Gonzalez asking the question of structure put in place, it's ultimately undermined by the police department and the institutions that allowed the position in the first place. Could you respond to that,
yes.
Michael Zinzin?
Yes. First, I want to say that changing drivers on an old raggedy car won't make the car run any better. We do not have an independent body with power to fire officers to change policies. The inspector general simply is an appointed person by another appointed person coming from a conservative mayor. We did not have real community control of the police, and we won't have it until the community, in fact, is the one determining the direction of the police department. That's where the problem lies, and no matter how many new people we have in her place, it will continue to be a playing a little game, diverting us from the real issues and the real solutions to our problems, not only in L.A., but throughout this country.
Talking, Juan was still doesn't quite get that you're not hearing him, but he asked about how the police commission was originally appointed.
Doesn't have the necessary independence of the mayor who appoints them to do an effective job. So they're basically a rubber stamp, And now, by appointing an inspector general, they're simply continuing that rubber stamp type position, not accountable to anybody but that conservative mayor. And we're saying that no one tends to be accountable to the community, whether it be the police chief, the police commission, or the inspector general. We need an independent body with power to fire police officers and change policies, and none of these people have that power.
Ramona Ripston, your response to the American Civil Liberties Union?
Well, In part, I certainly agree with Michael. Los Angeles does not have true oversight of the police department, does not have true oversight of civilian review, and we should. I disagree that Catherine Maida was a lackey of the police department. I think the reason that she is not there is because she tried very hard. She did a very good job. She was independent, and the police chief didn't like her. Edith Perez didn't like her, and they were able to persuade most of the commission that she was off on her own thing. So she was independent, and I think that an inspector general can be independent. I mean, if we're talking about an elected civilian review board, I think that's fine. But I think we have to deal with what we have. And she did a very good job, and that's why she's out.
That's the problem, the fact that they can get rid of someone who may have did a good job. They have the power to get rid of her, so you really don't have an independent structure in place to protect someone who may be doing a good job. Okay. And I'm saying that's part of this problem in Los Angeles.
Michael, I agree with you. As you know, we have fought for civilian review for forever, as long as I can remember.
Right.
But I want to say that there are a lot of problems, and just now calling for a new structure completely is something that maybe we could get from the Charter Commission, but I doubt it. We've got to look at what the situation is now. One of the problems is Joe Gunn. Joe Gunn is the executive director of the police commission. He is a longtime cop. He wants to have control of the inspector general. Deidre Hill is a decent, good person. I've worked with her. She believes in disciplining officers and civilian control. But the question is she going to be able to work with Joe Gunn? Joe Gunn wants to change the structure so that the inspector general reports to him. There are a lot of problems that have suddenly surfaced in the police department. And while I agree that the long-term strategy is a new way of achieving civilian control, we got to look at what we have today and where do we go from here.
Well, I do look at it because we take a lot of complaints, and I hope everybody hears this. We take a lot of complaints. I've approached that inspector general's body, and they do not investigate independently. They say that they rely on the police to turn in their investigation, like Jesse James investigating Frank James. They take the information. They don't have the power to do a subpoena, to do some serious investigations on officer-involved shootings and serious beatings. And we've been hitting up against the wall because we've approached her people constantly, and this is what we've gotten. Well, we really can't independently investigate. Well, then why are you there? This is what we oppose. We say that they don't have the power to say, police commission, police officers, get back. We're going to make an investigation, and if we find you wrong, we are going to go after you just like anybody else. If we have to fire you, put you in jail, change policies, we can do that. She is not in a position, her position is not in a position to make real change, and so we simply have that circle going around and around. We need community control of the police. We need to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. We need community control nationwide, and to that extent, I hope people call the Coalition Against Police Abuse at area code 213-733-2107, and let's build that genuine national united front to end this police abuse by any means necessary.
Ramona Ripston, we have to break in for a minute for stations to identify themselves. We're going to finish up the discussion after the break. Our guests are Ramona Ripston, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California, and Michael Zinzon, Chair of the Coalition Against Police Abuse in Los Angeles. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Love.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. My co-host is Juan Gonzalez in New York, now joining us by phone. And we are wrapping up this discussion about police brutality and police, a watchdog who has just resigned in Los Angeles. Again, Catherine Mader, who is the first police inspector general. She was appointed after the Rodney King beating and after the Christopher Commission came out with its report. She has resigned, a surprise to many this week, saying she could not operate with the independence and the access that she needed to continue. Our guests, Ramona Ripston, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California, and Michael Zinzin, who is chair of the Coalition Against Police Abuse in Los Angeles. He himself also a victim of police brutality in Pasadena, for which he won a large settlement. Ultimately, he had sued. Ramona Ripston, you were just responding to Michael Zinzin.
There's no doubt that what Michael says is absolutely right. I mean, we've worked, ACLU has worked for police reform, for a civilian review of the police, and we've worked with Michael, and everything that Michael said is true. But we have been fighting that battle for 30 years, and we have not achieved what we want. So all that I'm saying is that, sure, long term, we certainly need true civilian oversight with subpoena power, with the ability to investigate all complaints of police misconduct. But we have a situation today where the one positive step that's been made in the last years, Catherine Mader, Inspector General, has just either quit or lost her job. She even says in this morning's newspaper that she lost her job because the police commission was weakening what she was able to do. So if she loses her job for doing that, we have to be concerned about who the next inspector general is, who is watching the police department, who's going to the police commission meetings every Tuesday, what are they doing. We have long-term goals, those that Michael articulated so well, and we better have some short-term goals about what's happening at this moment, because otherwise there's going to be a lot more of the return to the past, and I think that that's worrisome.
Well, I'd like to ask Ramona Ripston, because in other cities there have been civilian review boards instituted, some with subpoena power in New York and Philadelphia and other cities, yet the problem of police abuse continues, and then these new institutions then get attacked or crippled by mayors or police departments that are opposed to them. So isn't the problem, doesn't it go beyond, as I raised before, the issue of a structural realignment of within the police department, and it goes more to the question that police departments all around this country have to be reconstituted, and their members have to be re-educated in the terms of how they relate to civilians in this country, especially to people in third world communities.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. There is something wrong with the way police officers are trained. There's something wrong with the structure of the police department. It is a paramilitary force. Occasionally, a civilian review board has worked, but in other places, it hasn't worked. And a lot of it has to do with the culture of the police department. I really believe we need to look at other kinds of people becoming part of the police department.
I think we also have to keep in mind that if we want to address that question, we have to look at the question of the state, racism and white supremacy, the kind of policies that nationally are being implemented by local law enforcement. So if we want to address that, but we can't say that some little rubber-stamped review board like the one in New York that ain't got no teeth is a failure because elected review boards don't work. I'm saying
I didn't say that it didn't work.
No, I'm not saying you. I'm saying I'm raising to him, Ramona. I'm saying that we need one that has the power to stop the spying, the violations of human and civil rights, have the power to review and alter police procedures. And I'm saying that we need that now. And I'm saying that until we get that, we still need to address the question of police abuse, and we need to take that power away from that little raggedy police commission. We need to say that if they don't have an independent watchdog group, if they're going to run out anybody who wants to stand up independently, then we don't need that either.
Now, Michael, let me ask you this. I mean, I agree with you in principle. What's the next step? You give me the next step what we should be doing.
I think what we need to do is join that national campaign to have a nationwide independent investigators, independent prosecutors, where we may have to bring people in. We can't rely on the DA's office anymore. They wait for the investigations to be handled by the police, too. I think we're looking at a systemic problem, and the reality is we cannot successfully resolve this in one location because it's a national problem of racism, racist policies, and white supremacy. And I think that if we address those things, if we address the class question, then we begin to see the national character of this and how we need to team up with others to change something. We're not going to change it overnight. It didn't start overnight, but we can make a difference if we begin linking on a national level.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Ramona Ripston has been our guest, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California, as well as Michael Zinzin, Chair
of
the Coalition Against Police Abuse.
Thank you. Thank you. Stop execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, it's certainly the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is one we're going to continue to cover extensively, and the activism around it around the country. As last week, for any listeners who didn't hear this, the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court ruled against Mumia Abu-Jamal in a new trial, though that is being appealed. Certainly the only arena we look to now cannot only be the courts, and we will continue to play Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries and keep people updated on the case. I want to give you Michael Zinzin's number again that he just gave, Coalition Against Police Abuse in Los Angeles. It is 213-733-2107. And Ramona Ripston, if people want to get in touch with the ACLU of Southern California. Well, we'll get that number to our listeners later. I want to thank you both for being with us. And now we're going to turn to an international brutality issue, and it is the issue of East Timor, this on the 7th anniversary of the Indonesian massacre of innocent Timorese civilians. 7 years ago today, on November 12, 1991, Indonesian troops armed with American-made M16 rifles fired into a crowd of several thousand unarmed East Timorese civilians who had gathered at the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili, the capital of East Timor. The Indonesian military gunned down more than 270 of those Timorese, and yet this was not one of the larger massacres in East Timor. I witnessed that massacre along with another journalist, Alan Nairn, and we did a documentary on it a year after the massacre took place. We're going to play an excerpt of the moment of that massacre. This was a massacre that took place as these Timorese who had marched to the cemetery were remembering a young man who had been killed 2 weeks before by the Indonesian military. His name was Sebastio Gomez. And then we're going to turn to some activists in Los Angeles, part of the East Timor Action Network, about the organizing that's going on today in Los Angeles and around the country. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastio's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastio's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting.
No! Viva! Viva!
The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion. Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we as foreign journalists could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
Soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down, just torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. And the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
That an excerpt of the documentary Massacre, The Story of East Timor, and that massacre did take place 7 years ago today, November 12, 1991, in the capital of East Timor, Dili. Again, more than 270 Timorese were killed on that day by Indonesian soldiers carrying U.S. weapons. We are joined right now by Matthew Jardine. He's a member of the East Timor Action Network Los Angeles, an author of Genocide in Paradise, and co-author with Constancio Pinto of East Timor's Unfinished Struggle Inside the East Timorese Resistance. We're also joined by Helmi Wattamena, who is chair of the Indonesian Democratic Institute in California as well, and a member of the East Timor Action Network. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Matthew Jardine, can you tell us the latest that is happening in East Timor? We just had reports of something going on in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, conflicting reports on military either using live bullets or firing warning shots and tear gas today, warning shots I think also being live bullets that may have hurt students who are marching on the parliament once again.
Right. I heard the same reports. I don't have any more specific information about what's going on in Jakarta proper. In terms of East Timor, they're 12 hours ahead of us, and there they had big demonstrations to commemorate the 7th anniversary of the Santa Cruz massacre that the excerpt from your documentary just described. And these they took place at churches throughout East Timor, and then there was a demonstration, a commemoration at the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili. From what I understand, things went rather peacefully, but the reports are still very preliminary.
Can you very briefly tell us the latest that has gone on in this country around activism, like the East Timor Action Network that you're a part of, that has had impact on the U.S. government? And it's what has been for more than 23 years now of this occupation, support of the Indonesian military and the genocide in Timor.
Right. There's been a number of very significant developments. In July, I believe, the U.S. Senate unanimously passed a resolution calling upon President Clinton to actively support the U.N. resolutions on East Timor, which call for the Indonesian military to withdraw without delay from East Timor and to allow for the establishment of the conditions necessary to hold an internationally supervised referendum on self-determination. In other words, a vote so the people of East Timor can decide their own political fate. So this called for Clinton to support this process and work actively with U.S. allies and the United Nations to realize this. It's very significant. And then in October, the Omnibus Appropriations Act of 1998 passed. This is the major spending bill. And this reiterated language that cut off all U.S. arms sales to Indonesia, in which Indonesia could not guarantee that the weapons would not be used in East Timor. So Indonesia must certify that any weapons that it buys from the U.S., these weapons will not be used in East Timor. Most types of arms, like small arms, helicopter-mounted weaponry, any big ticket items like tanks or whatever have been cut off. So most types of arms sales, military aid, have now been cut off, although spare parts and some other things are still going on. And contained in this Omnibus Appropriations Act of 1998 was language similar to the Senate resolution. So the House now is on record as supporting the same thing.
And now President Clinton and Madeleine Albright are headed to Kuala Lumpur for the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference. So
that's right. And soon thereafter, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright will be visiting Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. And it is our hope that she will, she will put pressure on the Indonesian government to follow through on these UN resolutions. Thus far, however, the position of the administration has remained very, very problematic. Congress has made significant progress, but now the problem lies at the U.S. State Department and in the White House. They have yet to voice any support for East Timor self-determination, as called for by the United Nations, and seemingly are continuing the policy of complicity that has long marked U.S. policy towards East Timor.
Helmi Tuantamina also joins us in Indonesia and in the large Indonesian community of Los Angeles. In fact, Helmi, isn't it true that this is the largest Indonesian community in the United States?
Yes. We live in here in the city of Loma Linda. Here in 5 square miles, more than 10,000 Indonesians living here.
And let me ask you just briefly, since we just have a minute, how the Indonesian community responds to you organizing around East Timor and Indonesia getting out of East Timor?
Yeah, before this, they're not familiar with this issue. But last June, the 27th of June...
just have 30 seconds, Helmi.
Yes, and the Indonesian ambassador come here, and two Indonesian young men... yield to the ambassador for release East Timor because this is not part of Indonesia. And then the this Saturday, Indonesian organization hold the forum with Fernando Araujo and Yeni Rosa Damayanti talking about East Timor.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but very significant that people in this country know that Indonesian activists are also fighting for self-determination for the people of East Timor. Protests at Indonesian consulates around the country from New York to Los Angeles today. You have been listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Maria Carrion, with help from David Finnegan. Roy Hurst engineered from Los Angeles. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Thanks to Canon Justice and Madeline Schwab as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!